Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast. I'm here, and don't worry, this time I am not alone, because I bring you a fit and healthy Matt Roberts. Hello, Matt.
Hello. It's good to be back. Sorry for interrupting the programming.
Trust me, folks, it enables us to bring you a bumper tennis podcast today. There is lots to cover. We might have had to spend 20 minutes on Casper Ruud winning a clay court 250 had we recorded on Monday. We will be covering that, folks. Don't worry. It just might have its airtime squeezed ever so slightly by other events. And the other reason that this is a bumper pod is because, bonus, David Law.
Oh, I'm a bonus. Oh, I'm very, very delighted to hear
well,
it.
Well, you're supposed to be in Croatia, swanning around on a beach, aren't you? But by the magic of delaying the podcast by 4 days, you're here.
Yes, and aeroplanes, which got me here into my Solihull windowless room. But very happy to be back. Very happy, most of all, to see Matt looking well again. And hopefully that's the end of any health-related drama.
Absolutely. We've being the medics that we are, we've identified that this was a hashtag athlete-related illness for Matt. He's just adjusting to athlete life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't have blacking out on my Easter bingo card.
You're Holger Rune. You just need to figure out your hydration. Have the pickle juice on standby at all times. Who was it during Miami? Carlos Alcaraz. Even the famous Carlos Alcaraz struggles to hydrate appropriately.
He's loving that.
Anyway, right. There you go, Matt. A gift from me to you. No Carlos Alcaraz, of course, this week in Monte Carlo. We will be touching a little bit, seeing as we have had 5 days of Monte Carlo under our belts at the time of recording. We'll touch a little bit on what we've seen. And by that, I mean, we'll talk about clay court Medvedev, because it is the gift that keeps on giving. We'll, of course, wrap up what we were supposed to on Monday, look back on last week's events. But before all of that, a big breaking news story in the tennis world that needs to be covered front and centre. This from Russell Fuller's article on BBC Sport. The WTA has lifted its suspension of events in China and is returning this September. They've accepted that an investigation into the sexual assault allegations made by former player Peng Shuai will not be carried out by the Chinese government and are returning to China this year with a very similar pre-pandemic calendar of events, including the continuation of the WTA finals in Shenzhen through 2031. Steve Simon told the BBC, "We've been in this for 16 months and we are convinced that at this point our requests will not be met. To continue with the same strategy doesn't make sense and a different approach is needed. Hopefully by returning, more progress can be made." The decision means that the final 2 months of the WTA season will once again be dominated by China. Simon said the schedule will be very similar to the pre-pandemic year of 2019, when 8 Chinese tournaments were staged in 8 weeks from early September. And crucially, the season-ending WTA Finals will resume its 10-year deal with the city of Shenzhen. Prize money this year, as it was in the first year of the contract in 2019, will be £11.2 million. Simon says the great majority of players are in support of a return to China. And despite promising a hardline stance with the Chinese government in which there would be no room for compromise, he says he has not considered resigning. Quote, no, I would never do that to an organisation. It's about leading an organisation and listening to its members. We have athletes that come from over 80 nations, so there's plenty of different opinions. But the majority of athletes were very supportive of a return back to the region. We certainly have some that were not, but the majority, the great majority, were in support and are in support of going back. There was strong support across the members, the player council and the board. Simon says that this change of heart was not forced upon them by commercial realities, but accepts members would have, quote, sacrificed a great deal had the WTA Tour withdrawn from China for good. The WTA's boycott lasted just over 16 months, although no tournaments could have taken place in the country during that period anyway because of the COVID pandemic. Quote, we've achieved some assurances from people that are close to Peng that she's safe and living with her family in Beijing. Simon said when asked whether the WTA had achieved anything, he says he has not yet been able to speak personally with Peng. We do also have some assurances that there won't be any issues with our players and staff while they are competing in China. And hopefully we have received some respect for the stance we took. The ATP committed itself to 2023 events in Chengdu, Zhuhai, Shanghai and Beijing once China's COVID regulations eased. And the ITF said this month it is looking forward to bringing the World Tennis Tour back to China. Thoughts, feelings, reactions, David?
Well, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this since this announcement was made, and I've spent a couple of hours this morning reading and listening to what was said at the time of Peng Shuai's disappearance, and also at the time that Steve Simon announced that tournaments would be suspended and all business suspended in China from the WTA side. And I'll just read you a few of the things that I heard from Steve on CNN. You've just heard what he said to Russell Fuller from the BBC, but this is what he was saying to CNN back in December in 2021, 16 months ago, or just under. He said, there's too many times in this world when we get into issues like this, when we let business, politics and money dictate what's right and wrong. When you have a young person prepared to step up and make these allegations, knowing full well what the results of that are going to be, for us to not support that and demand justice as we go through it, well, we have to start making decisions that are based on right and wrong, period. We can't compromise that. We are definitely prepared to pull our business and deal with the complications that come with it, because this is bigger than the business. He later said, we said that if the Chinese authorities weren't prepared to treat these allegations seriously and we weren't able to have direct contact with Peng, we were prepared to pull all our business. We're going to suspend our events until such a time that they do the right thing. This is about the principles we stand for, the principles of women, and that trumps everything else. This is something we can't walk away from. If we walk away from this, we're basically telling the world that not addressing sexual assault with the seriousness it deserves and requires is okay, because it's difficult to do. That's simply something we can't allow to happen, and it's not something we stand for as an organisation. That's what he said to CNN back in, well, between November and December in 2021. Here we are in April 2023. No resolution has been reached, no success has really been had in achieving what he was saying that they were making the stand in order to achieve. It was a stand, but it was a temporary stand. In the end, Steve Simon and the WTA did walk away because it was difficult. They have not suspended their events until China do the right thing. They've returned because they weren't getting anywhere, and it was frankly, costing them too much. And there was too much pressure for them to go back. In their words, praise alone isn't enough to bring about change, is what he said yesterday. My conclusion is that to some degree, I'm glad they took a stand. I suspect shining the light on things the way they did and creating the noise that they did at the time may have improved things for punk, at least temporarily. But I think they were naive. I think they were naive. He was naive, demanding as much as they did. And I, having listened to what I said back at the time on the podcast, when Steve announced their measures, I feel naive because I believed what I was hearing. I didn't think that China would acquiesce and that Steve and the WTA would get them to do everything that he said that they needed to do in order for them to return to business in China. But I believed that they would stand their ground anyway. That was naive. I mean, he was unequivocal, though, in his words. He was emphatic, and I believed him. Many months on, I think, looking at it now, I find it pretty depressing, really, to hear the manner in which he's just walked back on that. Yesterday, just accepted that they can't carry on like this, and you know that they're not prepared to continue the position that they established for themselves. And you know, if I were him right now, having made this decision, or whether he's made it, or whether the board has made it, and he's had to go along with it. I would walk away if I were him. I think that's the only way you can walk away with the sort of credit that you established in the first place by making this stand. And I think it's a really sad day.
Matt?
Well, I think David said it extremely well. I don't have too much to add to that. There's sort of part of me that really thinks, you know, they did something, WTA, and that is better than nothing, which is, you know, certainly what the ATP did. But like David, I probably put too much faith in them and their word last year, and this is a climb down. Steve Simon said on this podcast last year to you, Catherine, we will continue to suspend our events until we get a resolution. And he's talking there a resolution in terms of Peng Shuai, and there hasn't been one. There's this sort of thing in my mind about the fact that, yes, I know they paid a heavy price for the stand that they took financially, but it was also a time when they couldn't play in China. You know, it was the easiest time for them to take that stand. And now suddenly the opportunity is there to play again, and they've taken that opportunity. So yeah, I guess those are my thoughts. I'm pretty deflated by the news. And I think David's, you know, laid out perfectly why we're all sort of feeling like that, I suppose.
Yeah, same. Deflated. Gutted, really. I feel absolutely gutted by it. I think I feel slightly differently in terms of reflecting on how I felt at the time that the WTA took and announced this stance, in that it never really occurred to me that the resolution would be the Chinese state backing down in any meaningful way. I mean, the WTA, in terms of impact they can have on the Chinese state and how they operate, they're not even a minnow in the pond, with the fact of which made their stance all the more impressive. I thought that, you know, as much as a negotiating position, Steve Simon had to say, we won't return to China until there's a resolution. I thought the subtext to that was, we are prepared to never return to China. We realise that that is the likely scenario, because that's how I felt about it. That I just didn't see any world in which the Chinese state are going to go, oh, the WTA aren't playing events in tennis events in Shenzhen. We must change our approach to human and women's rights. Just know that that was never a plausible scenario. So I thought the WTA had thought experimented it through and been prepared to never return to China, and maybe had costed that out. Now, I'm sure there were practical consequences that they weren't able to factor in. I think they've been let down tremendously by the ATP not standing with them. And, you know, that goes to tennis's fractured governance, which is somewhat of a recurring theme on this podcast that we don't need to go into. But as always, it makes any kind of stance harder. And it is a tremendous disappointment that the ATP didn't stand with them. And I feel with them on that. But this was never going to be easy. It was always going to incur significant financial costs, significant political cost. I thought that they were aware of all of that and prepared to take the stance anyway. Now, I know that the WTA are in dire financial straits. You know, the deal they've done with CVC, that's not the ideal scenario for them. That's out of necessity. This has and is costing them. I know it has legal implications because they are under contract with, in particular, Shenzhen. That 10-year contract is extremely binding. And, of course, legal challenges come with their own financial costs. But a moral stance isn't a moral stance if you bend to any of those factors. And there'll be a lot of whataboutery. You know, the WTA plays in the Middle East. It plays in Texas. It plays in plenty of other places with questionable women's rights records. Yes, everybody has to make their calls about which hills they die on. You know, we do it on this podcast. The hill that we die on is taking money from gambling sponsorships. We don't do it. You know, that is a red line for us. Elsewhere, we go on a, you know, case by case basis. The WTA chose, Steve Simon chose his hill to die on. And I respected that was the hill. And I just, this leaves me feeling utterly depressed, quite frankly, even in full knowledge of the practical challenges that Steve Simon would have faced for that stance over the last 16 months, because those were always going to be faced. And maybe I'm slightly more glass half empty than you, Matt, in that I think there's a world in which it's actually worse that they took the stance and then backed down. Because if you're a victim of some sort of intimate partner abuse or rape or something along those lines in China, and you've seen someone try to take a stance valiantly and in good faith, and I do think, you know, the stance was taken in good faith, naively, but in good faith, and just completely and utterly fail and capitulate. What does that tell you? Demoralizing. Yeah, where do we go from here? Will any players take a stance, do you think? The pointing in the statement, the consistent pointing towards the majority player willingness and keenness to return to China, I also find a bit disappointing, because while they are to an extent a players' union, and again, this points to the screwed up governance of the sport, but while they are a players' union, in this sort of scenario, the players' perspective is a pretty narrow one. And yes, they are entitled to a voice, but I just don't think that should be given the weight that it has been in matters such as this. I don't know. Do you think there will be any players that take a stance and refuse to return?
I'd certainly like to ask a lot of players. their thoughts. I noticed that a couple of the people quoted in Russell's article were those at the Billie Jean King Cup this weekend in Coventry, and Kjothvong and Katie Bolter on the British side and Caroline Garcia on the French side. I found myself wanting to hear what Elise Cornet thought, because she was the first player to draw attention to the disappearance of Peng Shuai on social media, which really started the snowball effect of people talking about her disappearance. I'd like to know what she thinks, and I didn't read any quotes from her. When I heard the way the tournaments are just back, and it's just an 8 tournament run again, and it's as though this never happened, and the 10-year deal will now roll on to 2031, and it feels like business as usual. We've heard these platitudes about we've had assurances that it'll be safe for players to go back to China, and okay, have you? Well, how can you be sure? How can we be sure that you're sure and that means anything? Because we were sure that you were going to stand firm on this point of principle, no matter what. And that has been left looking pretty empty words. I think that there will be players that feel strongly enough. Whether they boycott is another matter. It would be fascinating to find out. But when you think of the... I know it's only the winner's prize money at Shenzhen, but it's, what is it, $4.2 million. You don't need $4.2 million to win a tournament. You don't need it. And
I'd love to think that some of those top players would either not go or would feel, would donate that prize money to, I don't know, women's refuges in China. Yeah, but I don't know. I don't know. Look, we'll have to see, won't we? We'll have to see. Where does the story go from here? I'm not quite sure. It feels like there should be more. It feels like it can't just be, okay, as you were, resumed, forget it ever happened. It feels a little bit like that. It feels like I'm now going to move on to talk about clay court Medvedev. We're all going to enjoy that, and it'll just be like, okay, when do we come back to talking about this? When's the next, it needs to stay on the agenda, and, we'll make efforts to do that. It'll certainly be close to the top of our minds, but I can't believe that it's now just going to be, right, as you were, pretend it's 2019 again. But seemingly that is where we are. So, clay court Medvedev. I know it was always going to be an uncomfortable segue, David, so I thought,
I agree with you.
It's like on morning TV where you go from your political segment or your hard-hitting news segment, and then you have to turn to camera four and go, coming up after the break, we're going to meet the world's bendiest woman. Stay tuned. It is quarterfinals day in Monte Carlo. I'm looking at my screen, and Andre Rublev has just run around a backhand to hit a forehand winner down the line. He is 4-1 up against Jan-Lennard Struff, who beat Casper Ruud yesterday. So quarterfinals coming up, we got Rublev. I almost revived Casper Ruud in the tournament there, but alas, no, Casper. Rublev against Struff. That is followed by Taylor Fritz against Stefanos Tsitsipas. And then it's Medvedev against Rune, and then Musetti against Sinner. And actually, before we come on to talk about clay court Medvedev, let's talk about Lorenzo Musetti, who beat Novak Djokovic yesterday. Did it the hard way, came back from losing a heartbreaking first set, was toe-to-toe with Novak Djokovic. It was kind of one of those template sets of brilliant young player against Djokovic or other really top player, which is play brilliantly for a set, hang tough, hang tough, hang tough, serve to stay in it, and Djokovic ups his level just that little bit, goes into lockdown mode, you start feeling the pressure, boom, set's over. Then he comes back, stays with it, withstands a rain delay. I thought the Musetti challenge was over with that rain delay. And I don't know, maybe I need to revise my FANG assessment of Lorenzo Musetti a little bit. I don't know. David called this one quite early doors in the match. Just before David left us with a mic drop moment, he said, I've got to go and board the plane now. This was in the early stage of the second set. David said, I've got to go board the plane now. I'm backing Musetti to come back and win. And then you made the point, David, that Djokovic does lose matches like this in Monte Carlo. And it's like his sort of getting gremlins out of the clay court system event, or certainly that's what it's become towards the latter stages of his career. But I don't know, there looked to be issues with the elbow going on. It was a very grouchy Novak Djokovic, but it was also a very, very, very brilliant and, dare I say, fangy Lorenzo Musetti.
Listen, I'll have to defer to you and Matt for what actually happened, because I watched barely a point of it. It was just, I was following what you two were saying about it, and I was just thinking back to matches I've seen him play in Monte Carlo, losing to Alejandro Davidovich-Fokina, Dan Evans, David Goffin, Yuri Vesely. And thinking back, well, yeah, and what are the common features of that? The him looking grouchy, the him looking not 100% fit, because frankly he's not match fit yet. He's, and especially in the last two or three years where he hasn't played Miami and Indian Wells, he comes in completely undercooked and he's trying to get up to speed and he's not there yet. And it also doesn't matter that much, relatively speaking, to Roland Garros, which is the end game to all this. I do think it's a factor that he's the age he is, and there's probably a few more creaks when he's trying to get back up to speed from a standing start. And I would imagine actually that this elbow is probably that, although the fact that he's had a serious problem in the past must make you at least keep an eye on that, I think, for the future. But this felt very standard to me. This is the best day of Lorenzo Musetti's career, and it's just another day for Novak Djokovic to deal with on his way to bigger things, really.
Matt?
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Is it the best day of Lorenzo Musetti's career, or was the best day of Lorenzo Musetti's career the day before when he beat his teenage countryman, Luca Nardi, 6-love, 6-love, and celebrated like he'd won 7-6 in the third over Nadal. That was the moment where I was like, who is this guy?
That's a flex.
He let out this guttural roar, like, you've beaten a child. love and love. A child from your own country. Love and love. And he sort of wailed delight.
That was see, Catherine Whittaker, I do have fangs. Love and love over
it,
my
it was
countrymen.
More than fangs. It was like dead-eyed assassin vibes. Very bizarre.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed that. I saw him get quite a lot of criticism, but I mean, you always get criticism on Twitter for whatever it seems. But I quite enjoyed seeing that side of him. And that followed up a 6-love set that he'd put on Kecmanovic in the round before as well. So he won 3 sets in a row, 6-love in this tournament, and then came into this match against Djokovic. Look, I think generally I agree with David that this doesn't mean that much for Djokovic in terms of, you know, his bigger goals. Certainly the next one being Roland Garros. In fact, probably his two most surprising losses in Monte Carlo came the 2 years he won Roland Garros, Vesely in 2016 and Dan Evans in 2021. He always needs time to adapt on the clay. But he looked bad, and his forehand, which you know, we had Daniil Medvedev on the podcast over Indian Wells really sort of praising and saying is become one of the most dangerous shots in tennis, was sort of all over the place yesterday. And the elbow, I think, does give a bit more cause for concern than normal. There were some backstage images of Novak Djokovic. Monte Carlo's sort of gone all Australian Open with their cameras everywhere backstage. And during the rain delay, you could see Djokovic sort of throwing a sort of weighted ball back and forth to his team and really grimacing while he was doing that. So I guess that's something to watch throughout this clay court season. I do hope we're not going to have Alcaraz and Djokovic keep avoiding each other through various injuries. You know, I hope that this isn't too serious, and we see Djokovic at all the major events. So if it doesn't mean that much for Djokovic, I still think it's a big deal for Musetti. As you said, that rain delay, he had time to think about trying to finish that match off, and all the scar tissue that he built up against Djokovic from not winning from two sets up at Roland Garros in the past. You know, there was a lot that could have sort of malfunctioned then in that latter stage. And I was so impressed by how well he came out playing after that rain delay. He has the two things I think you really need, especially on clay, but generally to hurt top players, and that's variety and it's acceleration on his shots. You know, he can suddenly just inject pace. He's really bulked up in the last year, and his forehand is a big, big weapon, especially when he's got time on the ball on clay. So, look, I love watching Lorenzo Musetti play tennis. There's something, you know, we sort of talk about it with Alcaraz. It's amazing to watch someone have so many shots at his disposal and know how to use them. I think Musetti's more normal in that he's got so many shots, and we're learning with him as he figures out how to use them all. And he doesn't always get it right, but it's always great to watch. And he'd had such a terrible year so far, barely winning matches, let alone doing something like this. And it, you know, tennis can sometimes just work like that. And you know, he's now got an all-Italian quarterfinal against Sinner, and the atmosphere for that should be electric, because there's always so many Italians in Monte Carlo. And I think that sort of helped him a little bit yesterday against Djokovic as well.
Yeah, I'm wary of making this comparison, because I'm worried it's sort of lazy. Oh, they've both got a single-handed backhand. But that, it's Dominic Thiem-like to me, that sort of ability to hit big from deep on clay being the sort of the magic weapon, particularly against Djokovic. And that requires so much strength, and it's clear, you know, I said yesterday, I know he did a lot of bulking up, particularly in his upper body, what, about 18 months ago would it have been? Yes, Billie Jean. We wondered perhaps if that actually was affecting his play, because he really stuttered in his form after that. It was like he was trying to adjust to a new body and a new sort of set of balance, I suppose, set of balance, that doesn't make any sense. I think you know what I mean. But I looked at him yesterday and his legs suddenly looked like tree trunks. And it looked to me, honestly, like he'd gone to a fitness trainer, showed up in a gym, gone to a fitness trainer with a picture of Carlos Alcaraz and said, I'll have that, please. Do make me that. And, okay, I am joking, but I do just wonder, you know, Carlos Alcaraz lighting a fire under these guys. Runa had the fire anyway, but someone like Lorenzo Musetti in the same age bracket, that bit older, maybe he, you know, until Carlos Alcaraz started Alcarazing, he was being talked about as, you know, an anointed sort of only a matter of time before you start winning stuff and having the baton passed to you. And, you know, maybe players can be comfortable in that, comfortable in knowing, in, you know, everybody knowing how talented they are and feeling like it's only a matter of time. It is going to happen. Everybody's telling me it's going to happen. I'll just keep being me and it'll eventually happen. But Alcaraz is sort of short-circuited all of that, hasn't he? And, yeah, to say he's been ahead of the curve would be a tremendous understatement. But I don't know.
It is interesting, though, Catherine, that he's put all this work in, and he has been rubbish this year. I mean,
I don't think he can play on anything other than clay.
So, I mean, there's a massive problem.
I think we need to enjoy.
There is, but he was even bad on clay.
He was even bad in South America. He couldn't win a match.
Oh yes, you predicted him to win a tournament, and he lost to someone we'd never heard of in the first round.
I have gone big on the fact that Lorenzo Musetti is going to have a big year at the start of this year. And I mean, I'd written that
David
off.
Needs him to win Monte Carlo.
I need him to win Roland Garros to get any sort of kind of credibility back in the bank for me. But I mean, I'm like you. I love watching him play. He's got everything for clay court tennis. He's got the power of kind of like almost like team, but he's got that kind of clay court artistry of Tsitsipas as well. He really has got it all for clay court tennis. But he's been so bad this year that I thought maybe he's just never going to get this right. And so this is a huge shot in the arm for him.
Yeah, I do. I'm so here for the Alcaraz, Sinner, Runa, Musetti quadfecta. Again, not a word. Not covering myself in glory vocabulary wise today, am I? But yeah, little the new big four. There we go.
Mazzetti's loving that.
Look, it's early doors. That's not a prediction. It's just a
single
early
prediction.
Trademark. Yeah. Right. Well, anyway, he'll play Jannik Sinner later on today in soon-to-be-out-of-date tennis news. Holger Rune will play Daniil Medvedev, very much here for that match. Rune getting through as a result of cursed Matteo Berrettini. It's time to put the seal, I think, on Matteo Berrettini being a cursed player. I know you don't believe in cursed players, David, but come on.
Well, I've got to go, so I'll leave you to talk about cursed Matteo Berrettini. And I can't tell anybody any different.
Off you go, David. Matt, he's a cursed player, isn't he? Signed and sealed.
I mean, for me, that was signed and sealed a year ago. I think it's only David who still needs convincing. Yeah, he'd won this epic match against Francisco Cerúndolo, and it was 5-0 up in the first set, Berrettini, and lost the set. He had an absolutely disastrous time for seven games, and yet still managed to overcome that and win. And I thought, you know, that was the moment that this season needed for him, and then he's injured and can't play his next match. I mean, cursed player. I really feel for him.
An abdominal tear. It's a part of the body that he's experienced recurrent injuries in, which is always a red flag. And B, there have been a lot of abdominal injuries recently, aren't there? So we kind of know the playbook on them in terms of recovery. And they're really hard to fully get over. They hang around, and they're very hard to train around, I think, because they're literally in the middle of your body. It's a massive worry for me. I guess his target now will be getting fit for the grass court season so he can contract some sort of virus on the eve of Wimbledon and further the curse. But yeah, my heart goes out to him. It's tough for Matteo Berrettini, but it does mean we get Runa Medvedev. And look, I'm here at the moment, Matt, for watching clay court Medvedev against anyone. I would watch him hit against a wall at the moment. But even better than that, watching him play Holger Rune. I really hope he said, "Yar in my face," Holger Rune shows up. Because that Rune against this Medvedev that we've been seeing in Monte Carlo this week is just a dreamy prospect.
Oh, it's clear your day stuff, isn't it? Because I mean, honestly, as you said, Medvedev could play anyone at the moment. I found I found his match yesterday against Zverev just so entertaining. There's been just something so funny about Medvedev, and yet also really good. Like, he's perfectly capable of playing really, really well on clay. You know, he's beaten Novak Djokovic on clay before. I think he's got a winning record against top 20 players on clay. I think this whole I can't play on clay thing might be his biggest troll yet. Like, of course, it doesn't suit his game as well as other surfaces, but he's perfectly capable on it. I think I did see some maybe little adjustments in his game. It felt to me like he was trying to get a bit more shape, a bit more spin on his forehand. He was certainly getting a lot more width on his shots. He was using the drop shot a lot. These are all good clay court things. And on top of that, just immensely entertaining as well, because he gave a quote after winning his first round match against Sonego, another really good win. You know, Sonego is a very good clay court player, where he said, on clay, there are no good bounces. Even when it's a good bounce, you're expecting a bad bounce.
So it's like a good bounce is actually a bad bounce.
Actually a bad bounce, because it still catches you by surprise. And there was this very good sort of choose your fighter sort of energy, I felt, because I think Tsitsipas had just played and was talking about how clay is like this canvas that you can paint pictures on, and it's the most pure form of tennis. And then Medvedev comes out with his quotes, and you know, it's just sort of perfectly describing both of their personalities.
Yeah, and yesterday, the Zverev match was it had everything. Two match points saved. It was played. It was the schedule had been heavily rain delayed earlier on in the day, so this was played late. It had passed me by a bit that Monte Carlo now uses its floodlights and it plays essentially night sessions, a bit like Wimbledon. It doesn't schedule night sessions, but it's prepared to go into the night. I've covered Monte Carlo a couple of times, and there were on site. I mean, and there were frequently, you know, a la Roland Garros matches that were carried over to the next day due to poor light. But I was very glad last night that the floodlights did come into play. Tsitsipas, meanwhile, was beating Nicholas Jarry and writing what on the camera? Something about a unicorn and a skateboard.
He wrote, right? Clay court in the US is like a unicorn on a skateboard.
When did he play on a clay court in the US? He didn't play Houston, did he?
No.
Have we put that into Google to find out if it's plagiarised from somewhere?
Well, that's it. I think this was an occasion where he panicked and had to use his own words, and that's all he came out with.
And that's what happened. I'm not sure he's ever played on a US clay court.
Very confusing.
Right. Very confusing. Back to clay court Medvedev, the match against Zverev, two match points saved. Sort of an edge of aggro all the way through that was really solidified by the handshake, which was... He just doesn't let you down on that front, Medvedev. You're looking for the handshake, you're waiting for it. And sometimes in those scenarios, you're so disappointed when it's amicable. But this one was absolutely glorious. No eye contact. It was actually Zverev that made it as eggy as it was.
Oh, yeah. It was cold, as Medvedev wrote on the camera afterwards, to, I think, describe the weather, but also... very apt for describing the handshake as well. As you said, Zverev didn't look at him, and Zverev was really annoyed by Medvedev during that match. I think two things in particular, and it was Medvedev's behavior as soon as Zverev went up a break. He felt like Medvedev was doing things to disrupt him, and in the second set, that was Medvedev like sort of took the net pole away after he'd lost serve, and you know, to sort of jokingly sort of lower the net, maybe, because I think he'd just hit a double fault, and the umpire didn't didn't warn Medvedev for that. And then when Medvedev went down a break in the third set, he ran off court and went to the toilet, showing great variety. That is a man who can pee slow when he needs to, or pee fast when he needs to, and that really annoyed Zverev as well. And it worked for Medvedev, because both times, yes, he was down a break, but he turned it round, and Zverev had some very strong words to say afterwards.
Yes, some quotes here translated by the German journalist Yannick Schneider from Zverev speaking to Sky Germany after the loss. He said, "He is one of the most unfair players in the world. I take fair play and sportsmanship very serious. He does not. He takes a toilet break when it's not possible anymore. There are 1,000 situations in which he feels that I start to play better and in which he tries to do something every time. I'm extremely disappointed from him as an athlete. Of course, you can argue that it is not good form from me that I get distracted. This should not happen to me, and it's totally my fault. And it really was bad from my side. But I still feel fair play should always be part of sports." Tough for him to have a leg to stand on with his track record of aggressively intimidating umpires. And that's probably an understatement on what happened in Acapulco. I'm not sure anybody considers Zverev sort of the gatekeeper of sportsmanship in tennis. But look, he probably has a point about toilet breaks and stuff. It probably is a bit out of order. We cut Medvedev a lot of slack, don't we, on that kind of stuff, because we feel like it comes from a good place. But yeah, there's. I'm sure I would be immensely peeved if I were playing against him. But I don't know, the fact that he knows it's peeving his opponent so much probably makes him more. You know, you're giving him the gift of being peeved, aren't you? And I don't think you're ever going to win that kind of psychological battle against clay court Medvedev, who said in his interview after the match, "Yeah, he served for it twice and probably should have won." No, he said probably should have done better. Oh, so great. So great. Now we get Medvedev Runa, which is a massive yes, please.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Let's talk about what we should have talked about on Monday, Matt, and wrap up last week. I said in my little 2-minute monologue pod that all you needed to know about tennis last week, if you were going to watch or look at just one thing to summarise the week in tennis, it would be the Ons Jabeur front-on tweener in the Charleston final, which she went on to win against Belinda Bencic. The front-on tweener was obviously the cherry on the cake, but it was a fantastic final, wasn't it? That's just a great matchup between those two.
Oh, yeah. Just a brilliant match. Actually, a repeat of the Charleston final last year, which was also excellent when Benčić managed to win. So a little bit of revenge for Jabeur. And gosh, I mean, the shot making from both players was extraordinary. I sort of lost count of the number of set points that they each saved in that first set. And I really do mean saved. I mean, Benčić hit a backhand list worthy shot up the line to save one of the set points. Jabeur sort of responded with a forehand up the line to save one of the set points. And honestly, that tweener, which came a bit earlier in the set, was a big turning point because up to that point, Benčić was winning. And that tweener, and what I particularly loved actually was the composure after it to then hit the slice passing shot. You know, it must be very easy to hit a tweener and then sort of suddenly think, oh, well, I've peaked in that rally.
Or just stand and admire it for sort of 10 minutes. The thought of having to... It's insulting to be required to hit another shot afterwards.
Yeah, and yet she hit the sort of opposite shot, you know, a sort of really smart, clever slice cross court passing shot to get the break. And then after that, it was just a shot-making masterclass, really. And I was taken aback, I suppose, by how good Jabeur looked, because, you know, she really hadn't looked great over the Sunshine Double.
She looked bad, worryingly bad. I was pretty worried for her after the losses in both those events. I assumed either she wasn't fit yet, or she was, I don't know, so dented by that injury in terms of momentum and form and confidence that it was going to be a long road back. Yeah, really came out of nowhere for me, this run.
Yeah, absolutely. I think she said that she wasn't in danger in Indian Wells and Miami of making the injury worse. She just felt like she needed to get back on court. You know, she'd missed a lot of big events, especially for her, you know, events in the Middle East. And yet still I was surprised by how good she looked in Charleston so quickly. Didn't lose a set, also had a great shot-making match against Kasatkina in the semi-final. And yeah, I was just reminded of how good she can be, especially on clay. You know, this was her fourth title overall, I think, and they've all come on either clay or grass. You know, I think we've sort of got a lot of players who seem like hard court specialists over the last few years. You know, Medvedev, we talk about, Naomi Osaka is, I'm going to use the present tense, is very much a hardcore specialist. But Ons Jabeur is someone who has really thrived on the sort of natural surfaces. And I just think this final showed why. You know, she can hit winners from kind of anywhere. She can surprise you. She can inject variety into rallies. She's got great hand skills. And I just think having her back in the mix during the clay court swing just adds to what's already been a compelling WTA season. You know, I think we're all wondering how Sabalenka and Rybakina will do on the clay. We all expect Świątek to be brilliant. But this was just the sort of little hand up, I think, from Ons Jabeur. Like, you know, don't forget about me. I reached two slam finals last year. And I think I mentioned that Charleston final last year against Benčić. Jabeur's a better, more experienced player now, a year on. You know, she's had a lot more tennis experiences, and I think I would expect Jabeur to step up in maybe the bigger matches compared to Benčić now, and she certainly did that here. So I thought it was a really great final and capped off a really great week for Jabeur and an exciting story for the WTA to have for this clay court swing is Ons Jabeur being back.
Yeah, completely agree. And no points to defend at Roland Garros, of course. I mean, big points to defend before Roland Garros, but, you know, just as she didn't play the Australian Open last year, so there was nothing lost for her there. It's amazing she got her ranking to where she did with not playing Australia last year losing first round of the French, getting no ranking points for Wimbledon. Mm. I mean, it shows you how good she's been consistently in the last 12 months. And it kind of all started with that run to the Charleston final last year. That's where I think of her real role starting. So if this is the start of her 2023 role, and you know she's won Charleston this time, that's really exciting stuff. Exactly as you say, not just for Franz Jobert, but for tennis. The WTA was also in Bogota last week. That title was won by Tatiana Maria. She beat Peyton Stearns in the final. Peyton Stearns came to my attention in Indian Wells, where she lost out in three sets to Bianca Andreescu in the opening round. She was a wild card, I think. NCAA champion, Peyton Stearns, I think. And yeah, maybe a name that's gonna keep popping up. She's got good intensity. She's a real, as is quite often the case with people that have cut their teeth in college tennis, she's a bit of a street fighter, you know, a good watch, I think. But Tatiana Maria, experienced, loves, again, a natural surfaces kind of gal.
Mm.
I'd forgotten about that turn of phrase. Thank you for reminding me of it.
You're welcome. It's just quite handy for grouping grass and clay together, even though they're probably the most, you know, opposite surfaces, I suppose. But I still think some of the skills can be transferable. And I think Tatiana Maria might be a Bogota specialist, because I think she won that title last year as well.
Like, do you remember Victor Estrella Burgos?
I knew you were going to say that.
Did you know? It's the most niche reference I have.
Did he win it 3 years in a row?
Three times, yeah. He's probably still just playing in keto week after week. Fran Jones reached the semis in Bogota, which is a cool story. I'm so here for her doing well. I've worked with her a little bit personally, and she's super cool. And yeah, I'm going to follow her progress closely, because I hope she can keep up that kind of form and start being a factor more consistently. The ATP were in three different places last week, all of them 250 events. Casper Ruud beat Mirmir Ketsmanovic 6-2, 7-6 to win the title in Estoril. My favourite thing about this, Matt, was the Ruud Ketsmanovic backstory. The pictures of them going back to junior days, and I think it was Tennis TV put out a little videos of their friendship, and I enjoyed it very much. It was very sweet, don't you think?
Absolutely. I just don't think that was your favourite thing about it. I think that was the predictions points that you got.
The points. Yes, my kingdom for the points. but the lovely friendship story was I didn't know about that. I'm usually really into, I feel like I'm pretty across, you know, player, heartfelt player friendships that go back to junior days, and I wasn't aware of this one.
It goes back to Casper Ruud's blonde days.
Mm. Who did you know about those days?
I think I'd seen a photo before.
I don't think of him as a crazy hair guy.
Oh, no.
It's like, you know, if it turned out he had a tattoo, I would be... That would take some getting over. Mm. Maybe, no, he doesn't have a tattoo.
No, I don't think so. And I think the way that I think about this title for Casper Ruud has probably changed in the last 4 or 5 days. I think my takes on Monday would have been different to what they are now, actually, because I think it would have been easy to just think, oh, it's Casper Ruud winning a clay court 250.
He's back.
He's turning in to Richard Gasquet. He's just cleaning up at the 250s. This is what he does, you know, and... I did, you know, there was part of me that thought maybe that was a bit different to his other 250s in that he really needed this. Like, he hadn't been playing good tennis at all. he took a while to get going in Estoril, but eventually he played pretty well. But then seeing him this week in Monte Carlo, he got quite a good win against Baltic van der Zandschulp, who has had his number, has beaten him on clay, in a slam, in a Masters event. You know, he's sort of ticked all the boxes against Casper Ruud before. So he did quite well to win that. He just wasn't playing well. And then to see him yesterday, I think it was, against Jan-Lennard Struff, he looked all at sea, really. I mean, Struff just completely dominated him in a way that he can. He can be brilliant, Struff, and overpower pretty much anyone. But Ruud is still searching and looks really frustrated on court, looking over to his box a lot, cannot hit his forehand the way he wants to. He's definitely not back. You know, this is definitely not Casper Ruud just suddenly being really, you know, like a top five player again. I still think he's really struggling, and, you know, sort of credit to him that he managed to win that title in Estoril, but it feels like he's still got a long way to go in terms of trying to reach the level he was at consistently last season.
I asked my dad at the weekend if he enjoyed... I'm always interested in who my dad enjoys watching. Both my parents, actually, because it's quite often different to who I enjoy watching. So I said, do you enjoy watching Casper Ruud? And he thought about it for me. He said, yes, I do. And then he paused again. He went, he's just so desperate.
That is a perfect description of what his facial expression is at the moment.
Yeah. He is. And I suppose that is quite compelling, but yeah. in Houston, where confirmed Stefanos Tsitsipas was not playing, Francis Tiafoe won the title. He beat Martin Echeverry. Does he have a second first name? I feel like it's not just Martin Echeverry.
Thomas.
There's another
Martin.
Name, isn't there? Thomas Martin Echeverry. I knew it. He beat Thomas Martin Echeverry 7-6, 7-6 in the final. Good title for Tiafoe. Unfortunately, the story of the week in Houston was the rain. I mean, they had an absolute shocker. If you think Augusta was bad for the Masters, they were sort of, I don't know how close Houston and Augusta are, probably not close at all, but Augusta were getting, you know, a snippet of what Houston were having. It's, at one point I thought, maybe they'll just call this whole thing off.
I have no idea how they finished on time. It made me think, do tennis tournaments need to be a week? Are we just faffing around? I mean, honestly, Tiafoe won that event in 2 days. He played all of his matches on the weekend. They started the first round and they were still playing the first round 5 days later. You know, every day was just absolutely decimated by rain. They didn't finish the first round until Friday, and that was the only match they managed to play on that day. And then they played all of the last 16 quarterfinals, semifinals, and final over the weekend. Kind of extraordinary that they did manage to finish. I felt sorry for Tommy Paul, who withdrew from Monte Carlo sort of while this rain was happening, I guess expecting to be there right to the end, expecting a huge backlog. And he lost his opening match in Houston and might have been able to make it to Monte Carlo after all. I don't know. Francis Tiafoe ended up withdrawing from Monte Carlo as well. Just really, really tough for them. But I was pleased that they got a great final. And it was, by all accounts, because we watched Echeverry, didn't we, against Murray in Indian Wells. And we sort of concluded, bit of a ball machine.
Lovely player, cannot hit a winner. Like, lovely strokes, but it reminded me of that traumatic experience of watching Kei Nishikori against Pablo Carreño Busta at the Australian Open, where it was like, just nobody wanted to hit a winner. Like, what is this? Have you forgotten the rules of tennis? It brought back that trauma for me.
And Murray Echeverry didn't even get to finish with someone throwing their bag across the court spectacularly in rage. But, you know, I think the point, I suppose, is that Echeverry sort of turned out to be the perfect opponent to provide Tiafo the platform to be the best version of Tiafo, because it was showman Tiafo. It was like he knew that they'd had a really horrible week of weather and he needed to do something, you know, extravagant and brilliant. And he absolutely did that. You know, there were moments where he was hitting winners and then immediately sprinting to the chair as he does. And just generally, it was a sort of great, you know, kind of like the Charleston final, just so much great shot making from Tiafo. And, you know, he sort of needed that. This was his first title since February 2018. You know, we think of what a good player Tiafoe's become, and yet he hasn't been able to finish tournaments off.
That's very Sakkari-y, isn't it?
Right. He'd lost a few finals in Tokyo, Vienna, Estoril, and this was his first time being the top seed, I think, at an event. And, you know, he sort of stepped up and really delivered. And I think it's another sort of notch on his progress, I suppose. So, yeah, great to see.
In Marrakesh, ATP 250 event there, won by Roberto Carbeas Baena, his second career title, beat Alexandre Muller 4-6, 7-6, 6-2 in the final there. Just before we leave you, a few other bits and bobs of news from the past week. Dominic Thiem and Nicolas Massou have split. Subsequent to that, in the last few days, we've had a sort of a glimmer of hope for Dominic Thiem in Monte Carlo, and then that being rather snuffed out. Look, I'm just so thirsting for any signs of hope for the Dominic Thiem comeback that I see them where there are, you know, I hallucinate those signs of hope. So I'm an unreliable judge when it comes to Dominic Thiem at the moment. But the Massou split worries me a lot about the potential for Thiem to call it a day on his career, because I think it was pretty notable that Massou was still there through everything. That was a sign of intent. And I don't know. I don't know the reasons that have been given behind this, but I'm not sure any sort of specifics have been given, but it feels like a potential tying up loose ends type thing. I don't know. I desperately hope not. But you remarked on it in Indian Wells, didn't we, when we were sat there watching Thiem, hopefully you said, Massou's still there, giving it the positive energy, and that has to mean something.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's been one of the most consequential player-coach relationships of the last few years, really, but both in terms of the impact that Massou had on Thiem, or seemingly had on Thiem, turning him, you know, into someone who contended with the big three and won a Grand Slam title and really developed into a great hard court player as well as a clay court player. You know, there were very tangible things that you felt like Massou was bringing to Thiem on court. And also from a just relationship point of view, the fact that Massou had stuck by him through all these difficulties, it made you sort of believe in player coach relationships in a world where sometimes they can, you know, they can be very choppy and they can change very quickly, that they really did stick together through thick and thin. So I was pretty sad to see that it had ended. I did read one quote from Thiem saying that it was mutual. You know, it was kind of like Thiem went to have the conversation and Massou said, if he hadn't done it, I would have said it as well. It just feel like it had sort of run out of time, really. And yet, like you, I'm desperately searching for signs of hope with Dominic Thiem, and there have been little flickers. You know, he has hit his forehand a lot better.
He has.
in the last couple of matches.
He's beaten Richard Gasquet, Matt. He's back. He's beaten Richard Gasquet in the year 2023. He's back. He's gonna reach the French Open final.
And he'd beat Ben Shelton, who had never stepped on a clay court until like 2 weeks ago. And I was like, oh, that's a good win. And I thought, honestly, even when he lost to Rune, I thought he still showed some better signs. Yeah. It's just how much longer can you put up with signs, you know, and eventually it does have to come together. So, yeah.
And I do worry about, you know, he needed that positivity from the Masu, but the box, it radiated positivity, that box, didn't it? I mean, I feel like he's always needed that. Even when the going was good for Dominic Thiem, that positive energy was important to him. And now when the going is so far from good and you can see him just getting down on himself and just that depressing look of why can't I do it anymore, that positivity felt even more crucial, and now it's gone, and maybe it'll be replaced, but maybe it's irreplaceable, or maybe he doesn't want to try and replace it. I don't know. Holger Rune and Patrick Mouratoglou seem to have split up and got back together. Honestly, absolutely. This is one of these like tennis players doing Instagram posts that I don't know what has happened.
Yeah, I saw Felix Auger-Aliassime's Instagram story. It was just him and his girlfriend walking their dog, and I thought that is what tennis player social media is for. Yeah. Whereas this was very confusing. I mean, I think they were never like officially really long term.
It was never official. He is my coach, right?
I think it was just, you know, I've used the Mouratoglou Academy. Mouratoglou's free. Let's work together for a few months. And I thought those months had just ended. Fine. No drama. And then Rune's first match, Patrick Mouratoglou's sitting there coaching him and putting up a social media post like, hey, I'm back. I honestly don't really know.
It had a very Sabalenka-Tursunov Instagram post about trips to the hospital energy about it. Speaking of Tursunov, he and Belinda Bencic have split. That news came out before Charleston, and Bencic's run to the final in Charleston. Conchita Martinez and Garbini Muguruza have also split, and that news comes on the heel of Muguruza extending her break away from tennis. We for a while weren't sure whether it was sort of an official break or whether her ranking, which is now outside the world's top 100, had sunk to the point where she would need to be either taking wildcards or playing qualies or playing, you know, ITF events, and she wasn't inclined to do that. But she did put out a statement again on Instagram this week, a rather more clear one, saying she is officially taking a break from tennis, and she's going to be extending that throughout the clay and grass season, which is, I don't know. If we never see her play tennis again, it wouldn't surprise me. If she comes back and starts winning stuff, it wouldn't surprise me. But yeah, that another extremely consequential and successful coaching partnership come to an end. And I hope we see Martinez coaching someone again, because she's a successful, strong, powerful female coach, and we need them in the game. So I hope she gets snapped up. And last bit of coaching news is that Caroline Garcia is back with Bertrand Perret, which makes total sense to me. When they teamed up last year, she had the best results of her career and seemed to be doing it consistently for the first time. She became reliably extremely good, and it was always a bit unfathomable that they split. All we knew about it at the time is that it wasn't Garcia's decision. I believe that was the official word on it. And it makes total sense to me that she would want to get that band back together.
Yeah, absolutely. And the timing of it was so weird, wasn't it? Just right on the eve of the WTA finals last year. It seemed like Perret was someone who convinced Garcia of the right approach, and she had no doubts about how she should play her tennis in those 6 months, and maybe has lost a bit of that in the last few months since the split. And yeah, if we get Caroline Garcia back from the back half of last season, that would be another great add to this already intriguing WTA season.
Yeah, hear, hear. So that's it for your coaching news. In soon-to-be-out-of-date tennis news, Rublev is a setup and 3-3 in the second against Jan Lennard Struff in the first of the 4 Monte Carlo quarterfinals. In women's tennis, there are Billie Jean King Cup qualifier ties this weekend, which we'll obviously cover for you on Monday's pod. So you only have 3 days to wait until the next pod. That pod, just like this one, is sponsored by On Location, the premium hospitality and experience provider. This weekend, they organise packages to the Masters Golf and WrestleMania. Two different vibes there. Something for everyone. I know which one of those I'd have rather gone to, but look, everything has its place. And in tennis, they are providing experiences with Steve Fogel's international tennis tours to Roland Garros, Wimbledon, and the US and Australian Opens, as well as Laver Cup, which is in Vancouver this year, Madrid, Indian Wells, Miami. They've got everything. So check out what they have to offer by going to www.toursfortennis.com. Tours, the number 4, tennis.com. A heads up for friends of the pod, or people that have been thinking about becoming friends of the pod, or meaning to become friends of the pod. We have 2 Tennis Relived episodes soon to be recorded that will be coming your way very soon. The first of them is about the life and times and impact of Nick Bollettieri, who the tennis world lost earlier this year. We've been gathering material for that one for quite a while. Spoke to Jim Curry about him in Australia when we did that episode with Jim Curry, and we're speaking to various other people as well. It is going to be a cracker of an episode, and hopefully a fitting tribute to someone that contributed so much to the sport throughout his life. And the second Friends Relived episode that we'll be recording is about, drumroll please, the movement.
Which is basically the life and times of David Law.
Which, honestly, great. Can't wait. Two different flavours for Tennis Relived. I think they're both going to be crackers. So if you would like to listen to those when they come out over the next few weeks, become a friend of the pod. The link to do that is in our show notes. As always, we have an episode mascot, and it is Ralph. Ralph is owned by Suzanne Virgona. I hope I haven't butchered that name, because it sounds like an absolutely lovely name. Virgona, I think that's what I'm going with. Ralph is a rescue dog, black lab mix. Yeah, he looks like a black lab mix. Oh, he's got that labby face and those Labradory soulful eyes. He loves to watch us cook and stares intently at the floor, waiting for something tasty to fall. Yep, that's a Labrador. He was recently diagnosed with Cushing's disease, so he's not as frisky as he used to be, but he's still always up for a nice walk or adventure. He's lovely. He's got that slightly greying muzzle, which my beloved Labrador Bella had in her latter years, as she became a distinguished elder dog. So Ralph is an absolute beauty. Thank you, Suzanne, for bringing him into our lives. We have our mascots. David has Maisie. I've got Xenia, and Matt has Darwin. Billie Jean, who made her feelings felt a little earlier in this pod, is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Jamie, Hannah and Drew. And shall we do shout outs or shall we wait till Monday when David's back? Shall we wait?
Let's save them.
Let's keep I
think people like both of your reactions to the shout outs.
Okay, noted. Noted. Yeah, little teaser for you. Tune in on Monday when we'll be back with tennis and with a bumper crop of shout outs. So thank you once again for bearing with us this week when we were unable to record on Monday. We hope that this was worth waiting for. Thanks as ever for listening to Friends of the Pod, for supporting the show. If you'd like to become a friend, then head to our show notes and follow the link. And we'll speak to you on Monday.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.